From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. A prominent anti-Cuba member of the U.S. Senate will apparently be facing federal corruption charges after all. The New York Times reported late Friday that the Justice Department expects to file corruption charges against the New Jersey Democratic Senator Robert Menendez. The Times said that the report came from a law enforcement official Friday. And according to some reports Friday, Attorney General Eric Holder has already signed off on prosecutors' requests to proceed with the charges. The investigation that has dogged the senator for the past few years was reportedly focused on his relationship with a Florida eye doctor who was a longtime friend and political benefactor, Solomon Melgen. Federal prosecutors said Senator Menendez did political favors for the doctor. The Times said that a lawyer for the senator did not immediately return a message seeking comment, but the senator and his lawyers have adamantly denied that he has done anything improper. The charges, which were also reported by CNN, are expected in the next few weeks, the official said. CNN had earlier reported that some charges may be coming up against the statute of limitations deadline soon. The ceasefire in Ukraine may be holding, but that hasn't slowed the torrent of accusations being hurled at Russia by the U.S. and its allies, with Friday's U.N. Security Council session being the venue of the latest round of anti-Russian invective. RT's Marina Portnaya reports from the United Nations.
Some Security Council speakers painted a very dark and grim picture. 50 shades of black is how Russian envoy Vitaly Churkin described the statements made by three speakers preceding him. During the meeting, Lithuania, the U.S., and many of its allies continued to blame Russia for numerous violations in eastern Ukraine, such as supplying anti-government forces with weapons, and as well as training and fighting alongside the separatists. Now, moreover, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Samantha Power, raised questions and hurled accusations.
2 days ago, Russia sent its 17th so-called humanitarian convoy into Ukraine, once again denying international observers and Ukrainian border guards the right to conduct a full and complete inspection of its contents.
Ambassador Churkin urged Security Council members to put less focus on casting blame and more effort on humanitarian assistance and saving lives in Ukraine.
U.S. Ambassador Power, I'd like to ask you to find out what the American embassies are doing in Moscow and Kiev and why they continue to provide you with cheap disinformation instead of these simple facts. The last convoy, as well as previous ones, have been thoroughly checked by Ukrainian customs and border control officers at the Donetsk checkpoint. These latest convoys provide more than 30,000 people with food daily.
The infrastructure has been devastated, and nationwide, UN officials say 2 million people are living in conflict-inflicted areas. Meanwhile, the U.S. ambassador is accusing anti-government forces of violating the Minsk agreements by blocking OSCE observers.
While there have been occasional instances when the SMM has been stopped at Ukrainian checkpoints, the restrictions on the SMM by Russia and the separatists are documented as widespread.
However, the latest OSCE report specifically lists 7 cases in which observers were blocked from verifying the withdrawal of artillery from the front line. The Donetsk People's Republic is listed in one incident. The other 6 cases, it is Kyiv's army that reportedly stopped the OSCE mission from proceeding with its work. Now, on a more positive note, nearly every speaker of the UN Security Council meeting, including the U.S. envoy, acknowledged that there has been a reduction in violence in Ukraine since the ceasefire was implemented last month. Something relatively good to report.
It was a perfect backdrop for a campaign stop, the legislative hall of the most powerful country in the world, and it had the widest press coverage of any event on earth for several days. But Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's appearance before the U.S. Congress this past week, which was widely seen as a campaign event for elections that are less than 2 weeks away, was, according to the latest polls, a complete flop. For more, we have this report from Press TV.
The Israeli Prime Minister's much-criticized speech at the U.S. Congress has not improved Israeli support for his Likud party. Now, that's what a first opinion poll since his speech has found. Now, a study shows that Likud's main rival, the Zionist Union, still holds a two-seat lead in the Knesset. The poll found the Zionist lobby obtains 24 seats if the March 17 elections were held right now. That would make the Zionist lobby the largest faction in the Knesset. The findings add to Benjamin Netanyahu's woes for losing the so-called golden opportunity of the Congress speech to impress Israeli voters.
Oil prices are back on the rise after falling below $50 a barrel in January. At the moment, prices are rising steadily, give or take a few slight fluctuations. The primary victims of the drop have been those oil-producing nations that rely on oil revenues to balance their budgets, with Russia, Iran, and Venezuela being among the hardest hit. That has led many observers to believe that the U.S. was behind the Saudi efforts inside OPEC that drove down global oil prices. But for some oil companies in the U.S., the rebound, which may be underway, could be too little, too late, with massive layoffs already underway and a shift in market share from the U.S. to the Saudis. RT's Igor Piskunov has more.
Global oil prices have dropped to their lowest levels in years in 2014, in one way or another affecting the entire global economy and especially oil exporting nations. There's an interesting political aspect that I want to discuss off the story with a professor of political science, Thomas Rotnam. Sir, thank you very much for coming here. First, let's look at the United States, which have produced record amounts of oil last year when high oil prices still made fracking profitable. But now the industry has seen up to 60,000 job cuts. I've spoke to the head of a local oil and gas company in Texas. He gave us a little bit more detail about the situation there. Before we begin, let's just listen to a bit of that interview.
The expectations now are that there will be 10,000 fewer wells drilled in the United States this year. No one can afford to keep workers on the payroll if there's no revenue coming in. And so the layoffs are a natural outcome of the low oil prices.
So the situation there is pretty complicated right now, and many blame OPEC, the club of the some of the biggest oil exporting nations, for refusing to cut production so that the oil prices would go back up. What's the role of Saudi Arabia, a member of the organization, in there?
I think it's Saudi Arabia has definitely had a hand in trying to undercut the fracking industry in America. And I believe it's pretty much had some successes, as you've heard here.
Professor, we've prepared this chart for you. It basically shows the OPEC member states here and how they are connected to the price of oil. And this is basically how much oil has to cost for them to balance out their budgets. Nevertheless, we've heard from the Saudi Arabian Minister of Petroleum and Minister and Mineral Resources, who said that they could still function normally their economy for up to 8 years, even if oil was at $20 per barrel.
Well, that's a question to understand whether it's profitable for them to bring the oil out of the ground or balance their budget. The two are different factors. Some say that the huge Ghawar oil fields in the east of Saudi Arabia can be profitable at $10 a barrel. If they cut their production and oil prices rise even further, those jobs in the United States are just going to flow back to the tight oil production.
So in these new conditions, would it make sense for Saudi Arabia to actually keep the oil prices where they are right now?
If they can keep it at $60 a barrel, they can take offline a lot of the tight oil production in the United States.
It's been a year since a Malaysian airliner disappeared somewhere over the Indian Ocean, and Malaysia's government said it's not giving up the search just yet. We have this report from China's news agency, CCTV.
On Sunday, it will be exactly 1 year since Malaysia Airlines flight MH370 disappeared with 239 people on board shortly after taking off from Kuala Lumpur on its way here to Beijing. No trace has been found of that Boeing 777 aircraft since then. Malaysia's Transport Minister Liao Tiong Lei says the Malaysian government will continue to support the search for that plane.
That means we have to go back to drawing boards. We need the expert to advise us how to move forward. I think we are confident with the expert group, which comprises of the one I mentioned just now, of international group, and they will look into the data and come back to the government.
International investigators are still trying to understand why the Boeing jet veered thousands of miles off course from its scheduled route before eventually plunging into the Indian Ocean. According to the Joint Agency Coordination Center in Australia, which coordinates information related to the search, the current search is expected to end in May. Lell said the search would continue after that. But Australian Deputy Prime Minister Warren Tuss has said a decision would have to be taken soon as to whether to continue into this vast 1.1 million square kilometer perimeter search. Tuss, who is also Australia's transport minister, said discussions had already begun between Australia, China, and Malaysia about what to do if nothing is found, including the possibility that the search might be called off within weeks.
This past Thursday marked the second anniversary of the passing of Venezuela's socialist president, Hugo Rafael Chavez Frietas. Hugo Chavez was remembered by many leaders around the world for his role in developing an alternative for so-called third world nations to the neoliberal model of debt and foreign dominance, using oil, among other tools, as a weapon of liberation. For more on this, we spoke with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, via Skype from Managua, Friday.
Nicaragua in particular has many, many reasons to be extremely grateful to Hugo Chavez, as do most of the countries in the region in one way or another.
Yes.
And so here, and that connection was marked by our President Daniel Ortega opening a national youth baseball park in Managua, which is very... It's very appropriate for, in relation to the anniversary of Hugo Chavez, because Hugo Chavez was a great baseball fan.
Yep.
And himself no mean player by all accounts.
Yeah, that. He's a soccer and baseball. He was a hell of a player, actually.
Yeah. So there's that connection. And also Hugo Chavez was kind of 100% dedicated to promoting the well-being of youth and children in not just in Venezuela but throughout the region. It was one of the things that drove his vision of an autonomous Latin American Caribbean region that was dedicated to the well-being of the human person rather than to corporate profit. And that was absolutely fundamental, you know, the taking care of children, promoting education, promoting recreational resources for children, promoting preventive health care for children and curative health care for children that needed it. Those are all very, very important components.
Eradicating childhood poverty, too, by the way, which, I mean, I wish we had with us, I wish I had the foresight to pull statistics, but materially, in Venezuela, and with huge rainbow effects throughout the region, with assistance from Venezuela, millions of children got those things and lifted out of extreme poverty into poverty or out of poverty altogether.
Yeah, and that focus of Hugo Chavez on promoting that, his vision was far into the future, so he... That's obviously why he prioritized the needs of young people and children, because he was thinking 20, 30, 40, 50 years ahead.
Yep. Right.
So you don't get people like that, you know, every day, and you don't very rarely get them even in a century, do you? And they're kind of a tiny handful of visionaries who really have the well-being of not just of their own country's people, but of the people of the world in their hearts.
Yep.
And that's why people love Chavez so much. And he was just such an incredibly giving person, such a generous person, such a capable person. And so I knew it was a very big day for everybody in the region, but and especially commemorated here in Nicaragua. And so in relation to that, and I think also there's some meeting. And another meeting of the of Petrocaribe ministers heading up over the weekend, and Petrocaribe is very much a child of the relationship between Comandante Hugo Chavez and Comandante Fidel,
right,
in Cuba. And it was their meeting in 2004 where they agreed to promote that kind of regional structure, an economic trade development cooperation structure based on solidarity, not on profit,
right,
based on people's needs and on the region's needs and on the needs of the different countries in the region,
right,
that drove that vision that led to Petrocaribe and to Alba. And I don't know how much we need to explain to people about what Petrocaribe is and what Alba is, but those two structures have taken on a life of their own.
Let me ask you, maybe one illustration of what Petrocaribe is would be how through Petrocaribe, Venezuela and Nicaragua have transacted.
Well, the fundamental relationship in Petrocaribe is that, and this is the Nicaragua joined Petrocaribe, and actually even before President Ortega won election to government back in whenever it was, November 2006, and even back then the Violeta. Sandinista municipal authorities were incorporating themselves into the Petrocaribe scheme, and then when President Ortega took office in January 2007, he formalized that relationship at a national government level. The fundamental deal of Petrocaribe is that Venezuela will sell people oil at the going open OPEC price, at the going international price, and the entity, whether it's a municipality or a national government or whatever the entity is that receives that Venezuelan oil, pays half the amount of half the sum due. I think it's within 90 days, and the other half over 20 years, at normally at 2% interest. And of course, for small Central American countries and small Caribbean countries that participate in Petrocaribe, and that being able to schedule their repayments of their oil bill over 20 years at ridiculously cheap interest is a vastly improves their cash flow. And if there is any conditionality at all attached to the Petrocaribe transactions, it's that whatever the excess money may amount to, that amount is applied to social purposes and to mostly to agricultural credit purposes. So, for example, here in Nicaragua, say that they buy $500 million worth of oil every year, just for argument's sake, and it's something like that, but that's not the exact figure. And then they pay $250 million of that down in cash to Venezuela. And the other $250 million is split, I think it's 60-40. 60% is devoted to promoting credit for small producers, for small businesses, small and medium-sized businesses, and 40% has to be dedicated to social projects of one kind or another, like improving housing infrastructure, helping people improve their housing infrastructure, helping local municipalities improve their road infrastructure, water infrastructure, and all kinds of social projects that otherwise wouldn't be funded.
Right.
And that makes a huge difference to a country's ability to meet the social needs of its people and to dynamize, if you like, to make more dynamic their economy for small and medium-sized producers, especially in the agricultural sector. And that Petrocaribe agreement here in Nicaragua rapidly gave very significant incentives to local producers here in Nicaragua. And eight years since 2007, something like that.
Yeah.
And the Nicaragua's agricultural economy has been transformed.
I mean, if you think about it, so you're Nicaragua, you've got $500 million, you have all kinds of social and economic needs in terms of development, in terms of basic needs of the population. And instead of spending that $500 million with Exxon or whatever, you pay Nicaragua $250 million of it. You keep $250 million to invest in the economy and in the population. And that's being financed by Nicaragua at 2% nominal interest. Venezuela at 2% interest. Rather than the competing model, which you would start out borrowing the $500 million from the IMF, and shortly thereafter you would owe $1 billion, and the money that you have next year would go entirely to the interest on that payment.
Right. Yeah, and that's why, Don, countries like Guatemala, the right-wing governments, you know, countries like Jamaica, for example, which is a kind of center-right government, as I understand it, and those governments are also part of Petrocaribe, and what you've just explained is why, because it gives it increase their economic options and enables them to do more for their own people. So, yep. And that's and it's based on solidarity and it's based on complementarity, so that, for example, one of the advantages of Petrocaribe is that you don't have to pay in cash. You can reach an agreement with Venezuela that'll say, well, a certain amount of that, the money that's owed to Venezuela, can be paid in kind. For example, Nicaragua pays some of its oil bill by exporting live cattle to Venezuela, or exporting quantities of the black bean that is the preferred basic grain in Venezuela. Here in Nicaragua, people prefer red beans, and in Venezuela, people prefer the black beans. So what's happened as a result of the relationship with Petrocaribe and Alba here in Nicaragua is that a new export market has been created for black beans. And that's part of repaying Venezuela the money that Nicaragua owes Venezuela. And try paying the IMF or the World Bank in black beans, you know?
So, yeah.
I know. I mean, just to go on, what in Nicaragua's case, Nicaragua took a political decision even before January 2007 that as soon as possible it would join ALBA. So ALBA is kind of the big sister of the Petrocaribe agreement, and ALBA has many more dimensions to it than Petrocaribe, in particular in terms of technological, cultural, and sports cooperation, education cooperation, all kinds of things, health cooperation. And so overall, with the combined programs that Nicaragua operates with Venezuela, between Petrocaribe and ALBA, the total amount of support and aid that Nicaragua receives from Venezuela is anything between $400 to $500 million a year. And what that means is that the recent case of Greece and its relationship with the European Union has, for me, has been very educative in many ways, because it really does highlight and contrast the real meaning of the European Union and its neoliberal ideology in terms of the needs of ordinary people in the European Union, in contrast with the vision that was promoted by Hugo Chavez and Fidel Castro, and is now currently being promoted by Evo Morales in Bolivia, Rafael Correa in Ecuador, Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua, to some extent Cristina Kirchner in Argentina, because Argentina, although it's not a member of ALBA, has also received many benefits from a similar kind of relationship with Venezuela. And if you compare that experience in Latin America with the experience of countries like Greece or Spain or Ireland in the European Union, you can see that whereas the European Union's rhetoric is that it's supposed to be a mechanism, a structure that promotes the well-being of the peoples of Europe, in fact, it's been very clear since 2008 that it's a mechanism and structure that promotes the well-being of a tiny financial elite, and while ordinary people are thrown to the wolves. And you can see that in the relationship between Greece and the European Central Bank, the European Commission, and the way Greece is trying to desperately reorganize its finances, while the largely German-led European bureaucracy is trying to crush that. It's trying to stop it. It's trying to stop the Greek government doing its best for ordinary people in Greece and prioritizing the needs of European bankers.
Right.
Because they don't want a genuinely democratic participatory alternative to develop that throws their control and power and influence into doubt. Whereas here in Latin America, it's quite the opposite. You have structures that deliberately promote participatory, democratic, economic, in particular, economic structures. And one of the fascinating things here in Nicaragua is the way the economy has been hugely democratized in the sense that probably hundreds of thousands of people, in particular women, low-income women, have been brought into economic life who before were excluded because they didn't have access to credit because for all kinds of reasons. And that's one of the reasons why Nicaragua has the highest rates of growth in the region, not because its financial elites are doing particularly well, but because it's broadened hugely broadened the number of people that at grassroots who are actively participating in the economy. And what you're seeing in Greece, for example, is the exact opposite of that. You're seeing hundreds of thousands of people in Greece deliberately being shoved to the margins and excluded from economic life. Sure. And it is a very educative and obviously very disturbing contrast.
You know what's interesting, though? Almost 2 years to the day Hugo Chavez reaches from the great beyond and places the Venezuelan and Ecuadorian oil ministers in Athens 2 weeks ago, I think it was. We haven't heard much follow-up, but saying exactly to the Greek government, to Syriza, we have some considerable experience in dealing with this problem.
Right. Yeah, and in particular Ecuador, of course, and Rafael Correa. And many people question Rafael Correa's progressive credentials, but in many ways he's been one of the bolder actors, the more active Absolutely. Players in calling into question the whole IMF World Bank system. And he insisted on an audit of Ecuador's external debt, for example,
right.
and they declared huge swathes of their debt illegal. That they that it was that right. the processes by which that debt was placed on burdened on the Ecuadorian people were completely illegitimate. So, and it's very interesting that Ecuador are in contact with the new Syriza government in Greece. Yeah. And of course the Venezuelan experience is that they will have been able to explain to the Greek government the benefits that Venezuela's partners have received from those kind of concessionary preferential oil deals.
And you know now, that's okay. Yeah. And what else is, of course, they had just come from meeting with the Russian oil minister in Moscow. And if you want to look at the example of Hugo Chavez and this model that he helped give birth to, the deal that helped bail Russia out of the sanctions that were increasing on it, the huge $500 billion oil deal with or natural gas deal with China, is also modeled on this type of economic arrangement.
Yeah, and the countries that are party to this kind of agreement look at how they can complement each other's economies, and they frame the agreement accordingly. It's right. not kind of, and who was it the other day that was criticizing the Europeans and the United States? Oh, I think it was the Chinese. A senior Chinese government official was criticizing the United States and the European for their policy in the Ukraine that is obviously deliberately designed to attack and cause problems to Russia and the Russian economy. And the Chinese minister said, well, why do you insist on playing what he called this zero-sum game,
right.
as though
right.
you're the only ones entitled to get any benefits from any given arrangement.
And, yeah, China's pushing and the win-win scenario. That's what
win-win. And, yeah. and that's just another way of talking about complementarity
that's
and
right.
solidarity.
That's right. We'll do what's good for you and what's good for me, rather than we'll have a parasitic relationship where I drink your blood.
Right, yeah. And that's exactly right. And of course, I'm historically, the Europeans and the North Americans are hopelessly addicted to that kind of colonial and neo-colonial relationship of dominant, the dominant power and the subservient colonial power or the subservient vassal state, you know, and they, that's what they've always been used to. And they're obviously finding it extremely difficult to adapt to a different kind of world, a multipolar world, where they have to treat other countries, even small countries, as equals.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.